Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Adore.fm, and ChiroRadio.com, and wherever else podcasts are available. Let's get started with the show. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 311 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom indeed, folks. Boom indeed. We've got a great show planned for you this week. It's jam-packed. Jam-packed, full of wonderful conversation. First up, we're going to have comedian Shane Torres from New York City. Originally from Tennessee, then moved to Portland, where I met him, and now resides in the great state of New York. Is a one of my favorite comedians. That has come out of the Northwest, and he's going to share a quick bit on, you know, where he came from and how he got into it. And he's going to be here in Seattle this week on the 15th through the 17th of September 2016 at the Seattle Comedy Underground. And I really, really highly suggest you you check that out if you're here in the city of Seattle. He's also going to be in L.A. on the 20th, the 21st, the 22nd, and the 24th, the 25th. And then, let's see, going around all around California. You can check out his show dates at ShaneIsAComedian.com. And once again, I highly, highly, highly recommend going and checking his comedy set out. It is fantastic. He's one of the good ones, folks. One of the good ones. He's doing the good work. And then later on in the show, after we talk with Shane, we're going to be talking with Brett Netson, of Built to Spill, and one of the bands that I have loved for many, many years, Caustic Resin. Actually, I've loved both of those bands, Built to Spill and Caustic Resin. We'll get into a chat with him in a little bit. But first, let's talk with Shane Torres a little bit here on the phone. Shane called me up a couple days ago, and we had a nice little chat. So
all
let's
right,
check that out.
Joining me on the telephone here is one of my favorite. Can I call you a Northwest comedian, or is that not right?
I mean, you can, I would say I started there. Yeah, I started in Portland, so you could say like Northwest roots. Like if somebody, yeah, I would say. I live in New York, but I'm a Portland comic.
Oh, I thought you. Oh, dude, I thought you lived in L.A.
No, no, I live in New York.
God damn it! That's why I, you know what? I rethought telling you the call-in time was going to be 4:30, because I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe he's on the East Coast right now. Maybe that doesn't make any sense. But it's all working out. It's all working out. Shane Torres, one of my favorite comedians that began in the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
So explain this to me a little bit, because you are actually not from Portland, right? Originally.
No, I'm originally from Fort Worth, Texas. Dallas is next to it.
Yeah.
But I... Yeah, I ended up in Portland 11 years ago, but I started doing stand-up about 9 years ago.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
So I just kind of just ended up there.
So why? Yeah, how did you end up in Portland, Oregon?
I kind of had this like freak out of like, oh my god, I could just Ken Barr forever in Fort Worth and never see anything. So I saved up what little money I had and just got in my car and. Was going to move to California, and then I was like, maybe I'll try another place, you know? And then I ended up in Portland, and it kind of just ran out of money here for 9 years.
And then you chose the life of a comedian and continue to run out of money. Is that close to the truth?
Yes. Hopefully that's all changing. But yeah, that's definitely the case at the moment. I have chosen poverty and our artistic ambition over, I don't know, a fucking subdivision somewhere.
Well, it's much more culturally better for you, right? For lack of a better term.
Yeah. I think so. Like, it's, you know, I'm very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But they say people tell you when you fall to follow your dreams, but when you follow them and there's no house along the way, it's a little depressing. But it's. I'm still happy I'm doing it.
When you follow him straight to the back seat of a 1985 Datsun.
Oh, God, I wish I could get a Datsun. but it's very, I am happy, but it's one of those weird things. Like, my friends are moving in and settling into their lives.
Uh-huh.
You know, like they're adults now, and they're starting to have kids and buy houses and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're like, that was so great what you did on that TV thing. And then I'm just like, can I please stay there? I can't afford hotels.
Oh, but man. Yeah.
That's changing slowly, but true.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing it, man. You're following your dream. You're doing it how you want and what you want to do. I mean, that's a very admirable thing. And you're very, very good at it, too, I must say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm coming along. Yeah, things are going okay. Yeah, but I ended up in Portland then and just started doing stand-up. Yeah, sorry. I get off track sometimes.
No, what made you want to do it, though?
I always thought it was, like, the funniest, coolest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was a little kid, I thought, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Look at these guys, you know? And they were just, like, impressive, and, you know, and some of them looked like me. They were, like doughy guys or whatever. You know what I mean? They weren't.
Right,
so that was,
right.
Like, neat. But I think mostly it was, like, I fell in love with, like, Carlin, like everybody does. And then, like, somebody introduced me to Hicks. My friend Sergio introduced me to Hicks. And I was like, this guy's great. And I was like, I should try to do this. But there was no place for me to try to do it. Where I was in Fort Worth that I knew of. I wouldn't know how you started, you know?
Uh-huh, yeah.
So, and then I just, like, after I left and had my little freak out and ended up in Portland, I was, like, seeing, like, oh, there's a local comedy show. And I just walked in and I thought everybody was amazing.
And who did you see?
All these local. Tristan Stillman was on it. Richard Bain. Andy Wood. Like, these guys who, Yeah, like, these guys who are, like, you know, like, were part of the Portland scene and have moved, mm-hmm. or, you know, are still, like, have Northwest roots and still around. Yeah, so I saw these guys, you know, and I can't remember who blew me away the most, but I remember recalling, like, oh, these guys are just doing comedy the way they want to do it.
Right, right.
It didn't seem familiar to me, and I thought that was amazing. Like, it was, like, it's, like, it was stand-up, and I knew it in that, but it wasn't at all like it was something I had seen. I hadn't seen it done this way before.
Right. It wasn't
like the first.
So it wasn't like
the first time
joke
you hear a
after
band
joke.
That really clicks with you.
Sure, sure. So it wasn't like joke after joke after joke, like one-liners or something.
No, it wasn't
that.
Like above and above, my wife. Above, you know, like, you
right,
do, like,
sure.
Richard was always so interesting, and Andy was tackling, like, had this really neat perspective, and. Spillman was more of a traditional vehicle, but also, like, it wasn't what I thought it was. You know, like, it wasn't like regular comedy.
Sure,
like,
sure.
You know, like the USA Comedy Hour or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It was based on it's like what the indie comedy scene kind of turned into is, like, it's based on, like, funny life stories, or just it's story driven rather than. Joke driven, right? Is that
yeah,
correct?
I would say all of it's any of it is can be indie, but it's like it's what you're doing. Like if you feel like somebody else could tell your joke, and it, I don't think that's a good thing.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
Like
yeah.
It was, yeah, it was always like people would be like, oh, it's, you know, I got these like To Catch a Predator jokes or whatever. It's like, yeah, who doesn't?
Right.
That's
right.
not interesting. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's like the way, you know, after like some band has a big hit, you see six other bands that are just like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That are trying to, you know, like, yeah, like that, like that's what a lot of comedy felt like before. But I didn't, when I saw those guys and there were a bunch of other people there, I think Hollywood Pan was there and I can't even remember, you know,
yeah.
who was there, but like, I remember thinking like, I was like, these guys are like, that's their joke. Like, it'll be like, oh my God, I love this joke. I love this
right,
joke.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's cool, man. I remember
yeah.
the first time I saw you, and the first time you and I met was probably, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago or something like that. You had come up. You were, let's see, you were doing a show at Laugh Hole, which was a show up here in Seattle that was put on by the People's Republic of Comedy. Namely, this guy Tristan, who used to line these shows up, and I used to do a lot of the interviews when those comedians came to town, and we had Ron Funches lined up to come on the show.
Yeah, my buddy.
Yeah,
yeah. I just saw him last week.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah. I remember that. Yeah, yeah. We did that interview in the back room, right?
Right, right. We were in the back room, and it just ended up. It was supposed to be with just Ron, but you guys were all so great. That we just ended up having you all on at the same time. It was like this Portland roundtable with you and Sean Jordan and Anthony Lopez and Ron. I stayed for the show afterwards, and I was just blown away by just what you were just talking about, like how each of you kind of had your own style, and you definitely had your own jokes. And it so fit each one of your personalities so well. And now that you say that, like if somebody else can do your joke, then it's not the right joke for you or something like that along those lines. Like,
yeah,
it
or
really makes sense.
Like, have your perspective on it. Yeah,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, you know, it's like easy to like you know, like whatever. Like, if somebody else thinks of it right away, it doesn't mean it's like a bad joke. It's just kind of like low hanging fruit sometimes.
Right. Right.
You know, like, and that's not something I was interested in.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was always important to kind of like stand out and be, you know, be an individual about it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you want to be.
Yeah.
You want to be a bit different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like it's important to be like an artist about it, not just a, you know, not a. Like a craftsman, even though, you know, there's a value in that too.
Sure. But
yeah. I was just like a fucking crazy. You're like, yeah, like this is the kind of jokes people want to hear. And I was like, why would you rather just tell me the jokes you want to hear?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Right.
I dig that. I like that, man.
Yeah.
So what was the move to New York like for you? Was it simply kind of a business decision to try to open up to a different market and get your name out,
little,
or just getting out of Portland?
A little bit of both of those. Like, it was like, certainly time for me to like make a move in another direction.
Sure.
But I was also like ready to go and leave Portland and be like try and get, like, New York is where, you know, a lot of people go to become great comedians, and I was like, I want to be a great comedian.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like that's the place where you can do it the most and all the time. So that was what was like really important to me. Well,
sure,
it still is. Yeah,
and are you able?
Like, I do feel.
Are you able to? Are you able to get time at a lot of these places too? I mean, like you
I'm
know,
getting. Yeah, I'm staying fairly busy.
Okay,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm staying fairly busy. Like, not as busy as I'd like to be, and not as busy as some other people. But it's a growing process too.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I will start to get more and become a better act.
Yeah.
Which I already am, but like I will become a more impressive comic to some of these people.
That's like, great, man. And it really shows, because like from the time that you and I met, and then we met again at the at Laugh Riot, which was put on by Derek Sheen there for a little while here in Seattle.
Oh yeah, you headlined that show. Yeah, Derek stayed with me in New York last week.
Yeah, he's a great dude. I love that guy.
And seeing
your progression from then to, you know, just like last year was an amazing, like, you were already good, but then to see you again after so much time had passed, like, it was just like, whoa, this guy is fucking got it. And I can only imagine what you're doing right now, dude. Yeah, I'm really stoked.
I guess we'll see.
I'm really building this up, aren't I?
Yeah, I know. One of your favorite comics. You didn't even know what time zone he worked in.
Hey, don't feel bad, man. I don't do a lot of research on this show. Even when I have some of my favorite like musicians on here and stuff like that, I know nothing. I know absolutely nothing. I go in blind. That's how I do it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love that approach. That winger kind of
stuff. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So you're coming to Seattle, let's see, the 15th through the 17th, correct?
Yeah, September.
Yeah.
And I'll be at the Seattle Comedy Underground.
Yeah.
Two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. I'm having some kind of trouble with the website getting my link up for some reason.
Uh-oh.
But if people show up, I'll be there. The link, like, if they buy at the door, and there's no difference in price or anything like that.
Okay, cool.
Between online. But yeah. But they're having some kind of trouble. Like, that's been a real irritating thing. Not that, you know, a million people are going to show up, but maybe after this podcast airs.
Hey, man. You'll be packed to the brim. Absolutely packed to the brim.
And,
right?
Oh, man, good. Yeah, you guys should probably show up early. even though I don't even know if it's, I think everybody said it's in a bad neighborhood. That's probably not a good thing.
The Comedy Underground is right there in Pioneer Square. What times are the shows on? That's 15th through the 17th.
7:30 on Thursday.
Uh-huh.
And 7:30 and 10 on Friday and Saturday.
Awesome. Awesome.
So two shows on Friday. So yeah. And I believe it's it'll be a good time. I'm not sure who's opening, which is going to be interesting, but I think she's super funny. She might be up there.
Excellent, man.
I think she's from Canada, but yeah, I'm figuring all the details out. Like, I'm at the club though, just 15th or 17th. I will be there. If anybody shows up, I would be so happy to thank you in person. I want people to show up so bad, and and I don't want anyone at the club to be mad at me, even though I'm not on the website. I'm just scared of all the time, and I would just love if someone showed up.
Hey, man,
not,
I
like,
think
more than someone.
I think you're gonna have a good crowd, dude. I can feel it.
I can feel it
in my bones, and I hope so too. Unfortunately, I'm gonna have to miss this one because I'm gonna be at a wedding. But I wish I could go.
Couldn't you have just said you'll be there and then like off the air you could have told me
do I need to cut that part out? Do I need to edit that out?
No, this is better.
Okay.
You know? Like, I think they'll respond to this more now.
Okay, good. Good.
But yeah, that's what I need from you as a friend and journalist.
There you go. Pretend. Let's be truthful about this. It's pretend journalism is what I'm doing right now.
Pretendalism.
Pretend. Yeah. I like that.
Where's the wedding?
The wedding is up in the San Juan Islands.
Oh, that's beautiful.
On Whidbey Island. Yeah. Hopefully, it's not going to be just pouring down rain. We'll see. We'll see.
I think you guys will be all right.
Yeah, I think so. Thanks, Shane.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll be fine.
All right, man. Well, hey, dude, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me for a second. And
thank you for taking the time, man.
Yeah, dude. And congratulations on all your success. Where can we find out more about Shane Torres? Do you have a website? What's your Twitter handle and all that stuff?
It's ShaneIsAComedian.com.
Okay.
Twitter handle is at Syrup Mountain, and on Instagram it's Syrup Mountain. And then, you know, if you Google me, all this shit comes up. Facebook.
Awesome.
You'll find it. When does this go out?
This is going to go up the week of, so it'll be Monday.
Oh, great.
Yeah, Monday before the before the shows.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to come out and say hi, I'd love to say hi back and do all that stuff.
All right, dude. And do you like hugs? Can people give you hugs or
people
just...
can give me. I need them.
Okay, good.
I got a nerve wracking week coming up. So any help is a great help. Any hugs would be great help.
All right. Okay, Shane. Well, we'll put links up to that stuff at our website at air-raid.net, and people can find it there. Go follow Shane on Twitter because he is a real treat. A real treat.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Shane.
Yeah, you take care, bud.
You too. All right, there you go. There's Shane Torres for you, everybody. Go to ShaneIsAComedian.com. Check out the live dates that he's got coming up here in Seattle, L.A., and beyond. Also, follow him on Twitter because he is an absolute, like I said, he is an absolute treat on Twitter. His handle is at Syrup Mountain. You can find it there. And one thing we didn't talk about, which I completely forgot to get into, was he was featured on the show, the television show, Comedy Bang Bang, with Scott Aukerman, who has also been on this here podcast a while back. So go and check that out as well. All right. We are going to get into this chat with Brett Netson of Caustic Resin and Built to Spill. This was a real honor. I was contacted by Dave, Brett's publicist, and wanted him to come on the show. So thank you so much, Dave. Thank you. This was a real treat, man. God, I'm saying treat a lot, aren't I? Yeah. Talking to Brett. So this one also done over the phone, while he was in a tour van for most of it. So, a little hard to hear at some points, but, I think you'll get it. You'll get the gist of the conversation. Just like last week, gets a little dark, man. Gets a little bit dark talking about drug use and where he's at, mentally. So, nonetheless, it's a fantastic conversation, and a real kind of bird's eye view into the life of Brett Netson and the life of Caustic Resin and you know what came after that. They are celebrating. Caustic Resin is celebrating the re-release of one of their best albums, in my opinion. The Medicine Is All Gone, that came out in 1998, and it's on vinyl, which Brett says is what it should be heard on. So I highly recommend that you get this album. I cannot recommend it enough. It is absolutely fantastic. We're going to go with our first musical break. Let's see. I don't think there are any tour dates that Caustic Resin has coming up right now. They're just getting off tour. So, maybe we'll update you on that at the end of the show here as well. So, all right. This was great. This was absolutely great. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this conversation. This one is called Hold Your Head Up, off of the 1998 release, The Medicine Is All Gone, which is now available again on vinyl. So go and get that, will ya? All right. Hold Your Head Up by Caustic Resin. We'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us, everybody. You're going to love it.
We'll be right back.
So,
sorry, you know, I figure if somebody gives a shit, it's nice to talk to them.
Well, I definitely give a shit. I came to caustic resin a little bit late in my I guess you could call it my listening career. I think I found out about you guys. It was the collaboration that you did. It wasn't exactly a split record that you did with Built to Spill, but it was more of a collab, right?
Mm-hmm. It was just basically us as Doug's band.
Oh, okay.
And then, but one of the songs is a song that I wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but that
so
was...
So there was one caustic resin song, and uh-huh. the rest were other songs.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a cover song in there as well.
What year was that? Was that 19... I want to say it was like 98 or something like that. Was that around that time?
No. Yeah, I have no idea. No, it was earlier than that. It was probably 95.
Okay. I'm probably thinking of that's probably when I first heard it.
But
I was blown away by it because I had, you know, been a fan of Built to Spill and was just kind of trying to like trace back the steps of Built to Spill and how they became what they were. Your sound, the stuff that you had been doing with Caustic Resin, was very prevalent on the later records of Built to Spill. And I guess the question I had is that I know that that Doug did a lot of writing for the band Built to Spill, but your sound was very, very prevalent and kind of changed that band around a little bit. Was that like a conscious decision to, you know, allow you to do some writing on the Built to Spill records, or was that more of just basically your tone?
Well, a lot of the Built to Spill records are different. They're all different.
Yeah, yeah.
I played on the first one.
Okay.
So the first one, the songs were all done, and then that was just a matter of me and Doug figuring out how to record them.
Right.
You know, he had this basic song done. So me and him together collaboratively just sorted out what guitars go where and whatever. And so I guess what it is, for the most part with Built to Spill, I write my own part.
Uh-huh.
You know, but he writes the song.
Yeah.
You know, and I would, various different times people have a little say in the arrangement, but for the most part, you know, it's Doug's thing.
Yeah,
you know? But all the stuff I played on, I wrote my own parts basically.
Okay.
I was allowed the liberty of doing whatever I want.
right,
which is really great.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I'm not very good at doing otherwise.
Have you had trouble playing other people's material in the past?
Nah, it's not trouble. It's just, you know, it's just like anything else. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, mostly it's usually a situation like that. People have usually just let me do what I want, you know? And
sure.
And they sort it out later. That's just kind of the way it is usually with an independent rock record, you know?
Sure.
I mean, yeah. I'm not like a studio guy. I'm not organized or consistent. there are people that are good at that.
Yeah, totally. They're called session musicians, right?
Well, just some people are, you know, really organized and consistent, you know, and that they're valuable, amazing people all the same.
Well, don't sell yourself short, man. I've always tried to emulate your style of guitar playing myself. And
and
you've definitely got a special sound all of your own.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're lucky if you got that, I think I'm lucky.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was the type of person when I was playing guitar in bands and stuff, like I was the type of person that really couldn't I don't know if I just didn't have the attention span to like work on other people's music. you know, to play like cover songs or anything like that. Or just, you know, actually it was probably a combination of just not knowing how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not as easy as it looks, right?
No, not at all. Yeah. So Brett, take me back.
I've been more interested. I've been more interested recently in playing other people's music than I was early on, you know?
Oh, you have?
Yeah, you know, like, you know, you're younger in the 90s and you think you're awesome and you got it going on and you don't want to have nothing to do with nobody else's songs.
Sure.
<You know?
laughs> Right, right.
But now you go through all that for years and years and it's really kind of fun to do cover songs.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Well, and I think the drawback for me was that, you know, I didn't see the value in it. But there's definitely a value in being able to learn other people's music because it definitely teaches you a lot of things too, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. So, Brett, take me back a little bit, man. Like, where did music start in your life? Was it early on? Did you pick up a guitar when you were a little kid, or did you have music going on in the house a lot?
Yeah, I had five older brothers and sisters.
Oh, wow.
And, so I had two older sisters that played guitar, you know, in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
you know, 70s style, doing Bonnie Tyler songs. And I remember one sister did House of the Rising Sun over and over and over and over again. And so, you know, I would steal their acoustic guitar and fuck around with it. And then they would, you know, yell at me and take it back. And
yeah.
So eventually I got my grandmother to buy me one.
And what was
that?
An acoustic steel string, or what'd you start out on?
No, it was full on electric guitar. It was
oh nice
quite the experience getting one of those at age 10. You know.
Uh huh.
It took a lot of begging and crying and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
Relentless begging, you know. And I went to visit her in Kansas, and we went to the music store for my birthday, and she totally just bought the thing for me.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, it was a decent guitar.
Uh-huh.
It was like a Les Paul with a bolt-on neck, kind of, you know, Japanese copy.
Sure, sure.
Probably wasn't too expensive, but it was good enough. Plenty good to learn on it. Great. You know, it was a magical thing.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Especially back in those days where before Chinese manufacturing, when every single person everywhere has one.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah.
It was a little more of a deal back then.
Yeah, I've owned a couple of those in my past. They've all seemed to give me rather a decent shock when I've stepped up to the microphone while holding them, though.
That's an amp thing. Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Something wasn't grounded. That's for sure.
It's backwards.
Yeah, yeah. So it was your sisters that kind of got you into it, huh?
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of music were they playing?
Well, like I said, it was 70s. Folky rock song.
Yeah.
Peter Frampton, Bonnie Tyler, you know that song Heartache?
Yeah.
Remember that one?
Yeah.
My one sister would sing that incessantly, and then my other sister would play House of the Rising Sun.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And mostly those two songs. You know, Eagles tunes, and all the stuff that a teenage girl in 1979 would be wanting to play.
Uh-huh. So what were some of the stuff that you started out on then? Did you get your sister to teach you House of the Rising Sun? That seems like one of the songs that everybody starts on.
I think that, no, I think that right away, I think the first thing might have been Blue Oyster Cult.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That live record came out and it was a big deal.
Uh-huh.
I got it, you know, it's pretty into the usuals. Smoke on the Water, whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
Smoke on the Water, Cat Scratch Fever, Living, Loving, Made, all that kind of stuff. And then I started digging around, got really into Robin Trower. I was really obsessed with Jimi Hendrix really early on, like at the same age, probably 10 years old. And the Wall came out, you know, right then.
Right.
So I had basically the cassette of The Wall and a cassette of Electric Ladyland. And if you look at that, it's pretty obvious all the shit that I ripped off.
I can hear that.
My mom was pretty into CCR. My mom and dad would get drunk and listen to CCR records, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Now, where did you grow up?
Boise, Idaho.
Oh, so you're born and bred.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I spent 7 years in Los Angeles at the turn of the century.
Uh-huh.
And years in Seattle, and I couldn't handle that. Went back to Boise.
Just too much population for you?
Yeah, kind of. Just you have to go too far away to get away from everything.
Right, right. Yeah, I feel it on that.
Boise. I made a lot of use of the wilderness stuff and all that around there, and I really missed it when I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You realize, you need to move away. You know, everybody should move away from where they came from because you really appreciate what's cool about it when you come back.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I'm going through the same thing right now, man. I grew up in a small town. I've lived in Seattle for probably over 12 years, 13 years maybe now. And I'm starting to feel that, dude. I'm starting to feel like I need to get away and get out of this.
Yeah, where were you from?
Well, it's a small town over on the Kitsap Peninsula across the water from Seattle here in Washington.
Oh, nice.
Called Indianola.
Wow.
Yeah, right on the water, cool. Man. It's a great, great little place. I love it. I love it over there.
Yeah, I know those guys over at the Liptek factory. I've gone out there to visit them. That's incredible stuff out there.
Wait, where's that?
Squim.
Oh, Squim. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know
north,
that.
North, right?
Let's see. Yeah, it's basically north and west. Yeah. Right there in the rain shadow.
Yeah, that whole area is incredible.
Yeah, it's beautiful over there, man. I just love it. It's totally true. It's like you get into a big city. I can imagine it's even worse down in Los Angeles. But it's hard to get away from everything. You know, you can't even get away to like a place where there's not, where you can see the stars anymore. You know, you have to drive four hours to basically just see the stars in the night sky.
Totally.
Yeah.
But you know, a big city's good too, because you can learn how to not fuck around and actually get shit done, which is sort of the disease of a small town is that people kind of choke on their potential over and over again.
Yeah. Definitely. I'd agree with that. So when did you realize at a young age when you first started playing guitar that that's something that you wanted to focus on and wanted to do for the rest of your life?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a bunch of other things too, but that was a big one. You know, I also like, you know, motorcycles and skiing and going fast and all that shit dearly. Yeah. But music is physically safer.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, yeah, of course. I got learning issues. I did when I was a kid. I was on the smart kid short bus and the dumb kid short bus at the same time. You know, and it was kind of weird.
You were right in the middle.
I mean, you know, whatever. I was an angry kid. Yeah, I couldn't. I didn't know how to go to learn stuff in school. And so you just pick up something that's not gonna fuck with you or make you feel stupid. And that's rock and roll, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I like that. Did you start a band? Did you start a band early on too? Start playing with other people?
So, well, the first thing I was in was a punk band, which was just dumb. It was ridiculous.
What was it called?
But it's called the Pugs.
Oh, right. I read
and
about
it was
that.
Like,
yeah,
kind of like it was like Agent Orange or something, or whatever were they into. Kind of uptight punk rock.
Uh-huh.
But I was sort of getting into a little bit of death rock at that point, so they kind of thought it was okay.
Right.
But still, I mean, it just was stupid. It didn't work. It was absurd. When you learn to play like blues riffs and all that shit, you can't get away from it. It just doesn't fit. You're stuck.
Right.
You know, probably the same with like metal. With metal, you know, it's kind of the same thing. Because it's, you sink real deep into it. To do it right, you got to sink real deep into it, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting because, every player that I think I know that, like, especially with metal, like, you can hear a tinge of metal in everything that they do on the guitar. It's always kind of there. It never leaves, right?
Yeah, sure.
Like, it's always...
I was into that stuff quite a bit, too, uh-huh. You know, but I really got kind of just swept away with, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Robin Trower.
Sure.
Hard rock, you know.
Sure.
For a while there, it was all Blue Oyster Cult and Iron Maiden and all that. So, yeah. So I got, there's aspects of that I love too. I think that ended up in Caustic Resin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I can hear a lot. I can hear a lot of Hendrix in your playing. With
slower.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. But a lot of that, you know, overly distorted, some delay, maybe, you know, even a little bit of wah pedal in there too, man. Yeah. That's my,
quite a bit.
Yeah. That's my, that's my first love, man.
Uh-huh.
So when did the Pugs ever, did you guys ever tour?
No.
No.
There were a lot of punk rock shows coming through town. We were just open for bigger bands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the way it was. That was like mid-80s. There was a lot of that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like No Effects coming down, shit like that.
Right.
Right.
So you guys were opening up for acts like that?
Yeah. Well, a small town.
Yeah, yeah. I guess there's not much to choose from, right?
No, there's only a couple places to play, and only so many people would go to the shows.
Right.
And only so many bands that could even play at that point.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, it was a little harder back then to be a band.
Yeah. So what, walk me through, what was one of your first shows that you played?
Well, it was house parties.
Yeah.
First show I ever played was actually with an industrial band, you know, banging on metal and shit at
uh-huh.
the bar, Crazy Horse, Boise, Idaho, which is an old bar.
Yeah.
I was underage, and I just played bass with a bunch of my friends that were just banging on metal oil drums and shit.
Yeah.
It was called Nietzsche's Birthday. It was one show only.
Yeah. How'd it go?
That, and then the other thing was a house party where we did the Pugs. The only real proper Pug jam was turned into a long freak out jam at the end, which was pretty fun.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
How
that was cool. But then it was at that point when I just kept jamming on and on at the end of the show, they realized that it wasn't going to work. That I was not punk. I was not truly punk.
Oh, you poor
It was
kid.
all over.
You poor kid. Were you heartbroken by that, or were you ready to move on?
Yeah, it was a little bit, but I it was very obvious. Yeah, I wanted to put on some kind of a big psychedelic rock show, you know.
Right. How old were you at this point?
16
years old.
Yeah.
So when were the first twinklings of caustic resin formed?
Well, that was I had another band called Sub Architects, which was a kind of this lofty, high-minded, arty thing. Because I was taking a lot of acid.
Uh-huh.
And had really big ideas about mixing physics and music.
Okay.
It was completely precious and stupid. And I'm glad it didn't last. But then,
wait a minute. You cannot gloss over that. That's it.
Doesn't that sound completely stupid? Like something a teenager would come up with?
I guess so. Well, definitely a teenager that was dropping a lot of acid. Like, what was the? I guess I just don't understand the concept. Mixing physics. With music.
Lofty notion of alchemy or something, you know,
okay.
Creating, like making sounds into physical objects or something. You know?
That sounds like a really hard thing to do.
Well, that's what I mean. I was pretty far out of time. out of touch with reality. I mean, or, you know, whatever. It was,
right.
But then Tom Romich, the bass player for Caustic Resin, he was a little older.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a little house besides his mom had a house, and there was another little guest house outside of it. It was like some old family kind of house, right?
Yeah.
But old Boise stuff. And he had the little tiny house up front, and I just moved in with him. We just took acid and jammed our days away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, you know, eating ramen and potatoes and on and on, just playing and playing and playing nonstop. You know, so I moved out of the house when I was 16.
Oh, wow.
Dropped out of school, moved out of the house, and just went and took acid and played music.
Now, was there inner turmoil
going
on? I mean,
for better or worse, that's what I did.
Yeah. Was there turmoil going on with the family? Is that why you moved out, or... You just felt like you needed to focus on music.
It was a awkward, dysfunctional situation, but it was nothing particularly bad about it. It was just there was nothing to it. You know?
Yeah.
Step siblings and just, you know, just dumb. Knowing what I know now, I'm like, it was just a dumb thing to do.
Yeah.
And my parents, to try to just put all the kids together and just, we were just all a bunch of kids together downstairs. Just
right.
They're like, you guys just sort it out. And they were kind of basically just unavailable, which, you know, was not bad, but I just couldn't really.
You needed some.
I couldn't adjust to what you're supposed to be as a person, you know.
Sure. Well,
didn't get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it kind of sounds like, I mean, I know as a 16-year-old, I needed direction, you know? Like, I don't know if I would have been able to function in that type of a situation either.
Well, I just needed something to believe in.
Sure.
Yeah.
And music was it.
You know, again, yeah, rock and roll, man.
All right, well, let's do this. Let's go with our second musical break. We're going to be featuring music off of your now new reissue of the seminal Caustic Resin record. And maybe, was this the one, that, maybe this is what I was thinking of that came out in 1998. Is that what I'm thinking of? All right.
Yes.
The medicine is all gone.
Sure.
Reissued on, is it on vinyl as well?
It's vinyl only.
Oh, vinyl only. Oh, man. Okay. I should have had that in front of me. And this one's called Cable. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Brett Netson. Stay with us. Okay, so you move in with this with the bass player who will become the bass player of Caustic Resin, and you guys are dropping a lot of acid, playing a lot of music, eating a lot of Top Ramen.
Yeah.
So does the idea of Caustic Resin start almost immediately, or did it take you guys a little while?
It took a while.
Yeah.
We were partying pretty hard, you know. We didn't have any ambition, really, to start a band.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was the impetus for things getting going, though?
I don't know. That was probably just a couple years of that, and then I got my girlfriend pregnant, so I think maybe that was the point where I figured if you're going to do this, you should get serious.
Really?
Try to do something.
Uh-huh.
You know. So that all kind of started at the same time. So, you know, I don't think I was ever ambitious to really make records or be a band or any shit like that.
So it was more, So,
yeah, so, you know, your girlfriend's pregnant, so you better figure something out.
Yeah, and, so it was more of a function of just like you knew how to play music. And that's kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, that's what you knew how to do.
Yeah. And if you wanted to keep doing it, you'd kind of want to figure out a way to make a few bucks doing it.
Sure. Sure.
Or something.
Right. Wow. That's interesting.
And at the time it was somewhat plausible to make money. All the Northwest hoo-ha was just starting to gear up.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so, so it looked like for you, it looked like more of a possibility.
Well, not a very good one, but
yeah,
something.
Well, you had to have made it. You had to have made some. I mean, just playing in the punk band, the Pugs, and opening up for a lot of the acts that were coming through through Idaho. Like, you had to have made some connections, right, in the music industry.
Sort of.
Yeah.
What ended up happening? It all came through Tree People and Third Fisherman. They're two Boise bands.
Uh-huh.
That were basically the first ones to get out of town and play shows in Seattle.
Okay.
And then they got noticed by a guy named Chris Tacchino, who had a pretty varied interest, varied taste in music,
mm-hmm.
and was writing for a paper called The Rocket.
Right.
And so he was really into Tree People and Dirt Fishermen, and then heard our stuff and, you know, was into it too.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, so he got us a show at the Off Ramp, and there was a write-up for it. You know, back in those days, a write-up was a huge deal.
Right.
And so we played the, it was like, we're kind of just fucking dipshits going to play in Seattle, and it was packed.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a write-up.
Yeah, yeah. Back when people used to read.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was weird. I mean, it wasn't weird, but it was different.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a good start to everything. We just kept just hammering it the best we could, trying to keep it together. Like, you know, a couple of us had kids. We had no money. You know, it's retarded. You know, couldn't barely get a band together to go to Seattle even. But, you know, just kept doing it the best we could.
Yeah.
And then, you know, more and more bands from Seattle were getting money.
Yeah.
So then we were able to do a nationwide tour with a band called Hovercraft.
Right.
Which was Eddie Vedder's wife. So he played in that band, their first tour. So there's some notoriety to them. So we played everywhere and it was full, you know, bars that were full of people, which was cool. I mean, they were a great band in their own right, not just because of the notoriety of said Eddie Vedder, who's a fantastic, you know, nice guy as well. But I mean, they were a great group. It was a droning noise, kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of fit in with what you guys were doing.
Yeah, we did a band with Earth early on, Earth and the Hell Cows, which was not a well-attended show, but it was a big thing for me.
Yeah.
Kind of just knowing that even if you're not totally a grunge, there was a place for you.
Yeah, sure, sure. Now, I mean, back in those, like, that's a good point too that you bring up. Like grunge was the pretty much the end all be all back when you guys started touring, and really trying to make cut.
Came a little bit after that.
Oh, it did?
But yeah. Well, you know, it turned into a media thing. It's total bullshit.
Sure. Yeah.
Because, you know what, Tad's first record, that's not a grunge record. That's like a blues record to me.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's just like real rock shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you got, like, all your other crappier ones. You know, Mudhoney to a certain extent. I mean, Mudhoney's cool, but, like, I don't really consider that. I don't know. I don't know what that is. They're different, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I see what you're saying, but my
camp, you know, there was the camp, a campy kind of a fashion thing early on, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was some kind of postmodern art project or something.
Sure. Well, and it kind
of sort of the birth of ironic rock. or something, you know, like ironic indie rock.
Right, right, right. But that style really took over, and like, it didn't seem like there was, or just from where I was standing at the time, didn't seem like there was room for anything else, right? Like nobody gave any room for anything else.
Sure. Well, it was just refreshing to hear raw guitars again, I guess. Well, not raw guitars, but like something other than hardcore, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you know, people got maybe a little tired of hearing hardcore constantly.
Yeah.
24/7. I was like, whoa, people are slowing down and stuff. And it was exciting to me to hear Soundgarden or, you know, Mark Lanegan's first solo record.
Uh-huh.
You know, Tad, like I said.
Yeah, yeah.
But see, there were all the other 80s underground bands that were just incredible. You know, Melvins had been at it since 1984.
Right.
You know, and there was Big Black and you know, so many of those bands. You know, it's incredible. Incredible.
Yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
Crash Acid.
So it sounds like this was a pretty exciting time for you, though. I mean, was this?
Well, you know, it really was, actually. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It'd be cool to be all saying it was like not mm-hmm. a big deal, but it kind of was. Like, you felt like you were in a situation where things. Sort of, it was an underground economy of its own. It's its own thing.
Right, right.
You go from Boise to Seattle, and you play in a place where tons of people are, you know, you play a place where the place will fill up. There's a killer PA, and people playing, you know, original fucked up music.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that didn't happen in Boise, Idaho.
Right, right.
You had cover bands. Yeah, so it was a big deal.
Yeah. And yeah. so you were having a good time.
Oh yeah, fantastic.
Now, was your penchant for psychedelics taking its toll on you? Were you still doing that?
Yeah, but you know, like I said, I had kids and I was doing the best I could, and they kept me from having a lot of opportunities, but just doing the best I could. And, getting away on the weekend and getting up to Seattle and doing Portland, Seattle, Olympia, and whatever, over and over.
Uh-huh.
You know, we didn't get to California until way later.
Okay. So you were keeping a lid, a good tight lid on the love for LSD.
Well, no, I suppose that. You realize later that mushrooms are way better for you.
Yeah.
plus, you know, you just have kids, you get more practical, and you got to keep your shit together.
Oh, sure, sure, for sure. I've got...
Especially
I've got,
being in the abject poverty, trying to keep together.
Right, right. I mean, you keep on bringing that up. Was there a real fear behind the excitement?
Behind the excitement?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were just talking about, like, these were very exciting times for you, you know, realizing that it could be a possible thing that your band could actually do a lot of great things.
Oh, yeah.
And people were starting to find out about you, but you still got to put food on the table, right?
Well, I didn't get that together. We, you know, their mom and I ended up splitting up and they're on welfare and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I was a fuck-up, you know, straight up. Total fuck-up.
Why?
I was just trying to keep together enough to be there in person to spend time with them. That's the best I could pull off. So
yeah, yeah.
I just did that. You know?
And you really think? I mean,
I couldn't just take off going to work for a year.
So you really believe that that because of the music and stuff like that, you were a fuck up?
No, I just was.
You just were? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Music was a good thing that happened.
Yeah. Have your children forgiven you for that?
Sort of.
Sort of.
Barely.
Oh, man.
And, you know, it's pretty fucked up. Everybody does. Everybody's fucked the kids up, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying my best not to do that right now.
I think the only thing I did manage to pull off is to treat them as human beings.
Say that again. I missed that.
The only thing I managed to pull off is to treat them with respect.
Right, right.
At least.
I think that, yeah, that's a good way to be. That's a good way to be. So, so fast forward, 1998 comes around. You guys release the Medicine Is All Gone album on the Alias record label. And there was quite a bit of excitement that that was coming out about you guys at that time as well, right?
I don't know. I guess. I don't know. Maybe enough. I guess enough.
Uh-huh.
No. I guess it was a known thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember hearing that record. It was probably a little bit later than 1998, but it was a mind blowing record, man.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was like I remember hearing the song "Cable" that we played a little bit earlier, and realizing that I'd really not heard anything like that before, and it was just it really. Like you know, you say you admired and kind of took a lot of your playing style away from Jimi Hendrix and things like that, and that's that kind of stuff really spoke to me definitely. And I, you know, I think you did a really good job with that.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, see, at that point too, there was also all kinds of other influences like death rock, you know, Kristen Hess, Society TV, and all that too.
You're breaking up a little bit on me, Brett. Can you find a better spot?
Nah, I'm driving.
Oh, okay, you are driving now. Gotcha. Yeah, I got you now. Yeah.
But there was all that kind of arty shit from the late 80s in there, too, at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like Bauhaus, Christian Death, Psychic TV.
Right.
Things like that. So it came out a little weird, I think, vocally, mostly.
Oh, I love it, man. I love what you did with that record. Was that...
cool, thanks.
I think I had read somewhere, too, was that one of the first times you guys went into like a really big studio and spent a lot of money on recording?
Well, it's the first time we had a real 90s budget.
Oh, okay.
But we did the record, we did the Up Records one before that, which was the same studio.
Oh, it was. Okay.
With all
gotcha.
The, yeah. That was Chris Keno, like got that all together. And that was a real live recording session. Kick-ass stuff, you know. And he taught us, you know, he taught us a lot about how to make a record.
Yeah.
You know, and mostly not by telling us what to do, but, you know, encouraging us to do what we do.
Sure, sure.
You know?
So who did you, who was the producer that you worked with on the Medicine Is All Gone?
Phil Eck.
Phil Eck, yeah.
And he also did the previous one called Fly Me to the Moon.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, Phil's that, a...
That's the guy Chris, that's the guy, that's the guy Chris liked, so that's the guy we use.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Phil's an interesting character, man. He's definitely got a... he's got an ear for that style of music, that's for sure.
Well, he's got an ear for guitars.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's cool.
Yeah, man, you know? Yeah. I actually had him
to bury the bass a little bit.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I actually had him on this. I had him on this show a long time ago. He came on.
Yeah,
he came on Air Raid a long time ago, and that was when I was using Wikipedia as my sole research platform, and it turned out to be wrong.
Yep.
It was terrible. Well, I was so embarrassed.
Phil was a disciple of Jack Endino.
Right.
You know, so he learned it from a guitar-centric point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
Which really worked for me, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So you're playing in Caustic Resin. You're also playing with Built to Spill at this point, too, right?
Uh-huh.
And, and which project, like, were you doing more with, I guess?
Caustic Resin a lot more.
Yeah?
Because Doug already had moved on at that point. His original idea was to have different people on every record.
Sure.
You know, so at that point, he had done the second record with his buds from Twin Falls, Idaho.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back for the third record, the first major label record. And then I was not on the fourth record, and then I was on the fifth record. You know, all that kind of stuff. So that was just a thing that kind of came and went.
Right.
That was just one of my friends. One of my friends asking me to play on his record. I'm like, yeah, sure. Do it.
Uh-huh.
That's about all it was.
Yeah. Were you getting paid for that kind of stuff, though?
Yeah.
I mean, it was still kind of a job for you, right?
Not a lot. I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't very much. But at the time, it was amazing. The most impressive thing to me was getting on a plane, somebody paying for my plane ticket to go to Seattle to play guitar.
That's like the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
So at any point during this time, were you able to kind of stop and look back and realize that you had made it to this point? Were you proud of yourself for being able to basically become a professional musician?
I wasn't really professional yet at that point.
Yeah. Well, I would say you were, in my mind.
Well, sure. But, I mean, what you got is not even really paying for itself, but you feel like you're on the right track and you're being respected on a certain level. That's nice.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't think about whether you've made it or not. You know, you got to concentrate more on making it every time.
Sure.
I'm making it right now.
Yeah. You're on a podcast. Woohoo.
I'm driving.
While you're driving. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, was that ever kind of the goal, though? I mean, were you ever thinking about that in terms of, like, you know, like you just said, like making it, quote unquote?
Well, that's what I was saying is that you don't ever make it. Like, you're making it as you're doing it.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So all I was trying to do is get that shit to pay for itself. You know?
Right.
That's all you want.
So that was kind of the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would have liked to made enough money to put on a bigger show.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Like Alice Cooper or Spiritualized or, you know, whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
Whoever does that shit.
Yeah.
But that's what I really wanted. Yeah.
So fast forward, what happens to Caustic Resin?
Oh, well, okay. We get the record done, and we're all just totally drug addicts and alcoholics at that point. And that was basically the high point of the whole thing, really, because shortly after that, all three of us in succession ended up in rehab in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
You know, I thought, you know, just whatever. It was, then you had to everything had to be rethought at that point, you know. You can't be just completely out of control. You know,
now, was it just too much of just partying while on tour? Was that the big problem?
That's kind of, yeah, suicidal partying. behavior, uh-huh. whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just start, after something like that, you just start focusing on actually just playing music and not all the other shit.
Right, right. Yeah. So was it becoming pretty volatile within the band as well between band members?
Yeah, we always used to fight quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yelling, hitting, whatever. Yeah.
That became physical.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Oh my God.
At shows, in the middle of a show.
Are you serious, man? I never knew this.
Oh yeah. Well, we were kind of known as being one of the best bands you'd ever see and one of the worst. It's kind of one or the other.
Oh my God.
I mean, pitiful. It wasn't like tough guy shit. It was like pitiful.
Uh-huh. What do you mean by that? Why pitiful?
It was embarrassing. There were people come see us play.
Yeah.
On the recommendation. In the last killer show we had, people would say, I'd tell all the friends come see us and then show up and I'm just be a pathetic disaster.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then like, oh, yeah.
So how did you come to the decision to go into rehab? Had you hit bottom?
Yeah, of course. Like I said, you know, you got kids, it's a little more serious.
Right.
You got to get your shit together.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's all predictable. That whole story is all predictable stuff. You know.
Well, I mean, it's part of of your story. You
sure,
know,
sure. But it's the same as everyone else. You do a bunch of drugs, you can't handle it more, and you quit.
Yeah.
And you do other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So how long? I mean, did you get clean after that stint?
Yeah, totally.
You did. Good for you, man.
Totally. I mean, it took a few tries, but not by choice. I'd rather not. But I'd rather be on DMT right now.
I know that feeling. I'd rather be two bottles deep into OxyContin.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but basically all it is, you know, music is more important to me than drugs.
Sure, sure. And so did Caustic Resin kind of dissolve after that then?
Pretty much. I tried to do it again with other people because one of us went to prison and, you know, various things, and it's just the greatest people I know got in this, you know, band, but it just wasn't the same. You know,
right.
Wonderful players, incredible people, and it just was not the same, so I just kind of gave up.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no point.
And so then basically you kind of moved back into playing with Built to Spill more then, right?
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Uh-huh.
I spent 7 years in L.A. building hot rods and stuff more than 7 years.
Oh, you did? That's what you were doing in L.A.?
I did like about 4 years of tours with Mark Lanigan.
Uh-huh.
Which was really satisfying. You know, that was cool. That was cool because I didn't have to stick around with writing songs and that shit. I could play all his kick-ass songs.
Yeah.
I didn't have to think about anything.
And was that planned for some pretty big crowds, I would imagine?
In Europe, yeah. Wonderful. Awesome. Totally awesome.
That's cool. That must have been
an honor.
That must have been a pretty fulfilling feeling, too.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Mostly just being able to play good music, you know, for little kids.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So once again, we come to the present, and you are re-releasing, like we said earlier, the Medicine Is All Gone on vinyl. Originally came out back in 1998. What went into the thought process on doing a re-release for this or a reissue?
There's the fact that it's possible, you know, the people buying records, which is nice, and I feel like it was important to make an all analog version of that record.
Yeah, yeah.
For kind of religious reasons.
Uh huh.
And because it was, you know, we were just lucky, people to be able to record in a studio like that with that kind of equipment.
Right.
You know, with a confident engineer, and it felt, I really felt like it would take it to its logical end.
Which yeah.
Is, you know, would be recorded on tape and then, you know, mastered onto a slab of wax.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I like it, man.
Just like a Black Sabbath record or whatever, man. Because it feels good. And it's not even just because of me, but everybody involved did a good job. You know, I think it's a special record. A lot of the records made around that time were special.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. Does yeah. it...
And so I just get the possibility of being able to sell it, you know, sites like Bandcamp and stuff. And
uh-huh.
Just people buying vinyl in general and, you know, heavy psychedelic music coming back into favor.
Yeah, yeah.
Which has been awful, awful nice.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. I mean, that sound is definitely kind of working its way back in.
Well, you know, our stuff is just too weird to even feel, though. But, yeah. But then, you know what I mean? It's nice.
Yeah.
People seem to like guitars again.
Yeah.
They're like a not ironic. Bullshit.
I love it. I love it, man. And so I got to ask though, like re-releasing something like this from your past and having to kind of, you know, re-listen to a lot of this stuff, does it conjure up a lot of these old memories? Not just like talking to, you know, jack-offs like myself who keep on bringing it up. But does, like, you know, does re-releasing something like this bring up a lot of those bad memories about some pretty rough times?
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, it wasn't all bad. A lot of those beyond awful.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, really, really, really good. Good time. Really far out shit.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great, Brett.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah.
Are you happy now?
Well, I don't know.
You don't know?
Yeah. You know, you do okay. Yeah. Yeah. Different. I think it's just different.
Uh-huh.
Totally different, though.
But, yeah.
I feel totally different.
Okay. Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Well, you know, yeah. Yeah. It's like this. I'm able to be helpful to other people now. That's the difference.
Well, that's good, man.
Yeah.
That's a good spot to be.
You make it this long without dying. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Brett Netson, it is an absolute honor to talk with you today, sir. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah,
I'm glad that I did not cause you to get into some sort of car accident.
Or just got into a parking lot situation around Olympia.
All right. Perfect, man.
Yeah,
well,
man.
Thank you so much, dude. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
All right, Ben.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, folks. Brett Netson of the band Caustic Resin and also of Built to Spill. I told you, man. Got a little dark. And, yeah, but it was good, right? It was good. Oh, my God. I remember after talking with Brett, I had this this memory resurgence of how many times I've seen them. I've never seen Caustic Resin play live, but I have seen Built to Spill on many occasions. And at one show, I think it was the first show I went to. It was at the Rock Candy. I've shared this story so many freaking times. And Built to Spill was playing, I believe, the Delusions were opening for them. And they invited Brett up on stage with them to play, and everybody went nuts, and I had no idea who Brett was. I thought it was like Doug Marsh's brother, because they look very similar. I should have shared that story with Mr. Brett Netson. Anyway, thank you so much for listening this week. A great time talking with you. Or at you, whatever. next week we're going to have the band Tall Heights on the program, and then got a bunch of great stuff planned, man, for the last weeks of the Air Raid podcast. So get ready for that as well. Thank you guys so much for listening to last week's program with Kim Warnick of Fastbacks. A lot of great feedback on that show, man. Thank you guys so much. You can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes, and if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. It only takes a couple seconds to give us a 5-star rating, and it really, really helps us out in the long run. Even though we're ending the show, it's still going to help. It's still going to help get the word out, man. We still want this thing to be up and out there, so there's a lot of great bands that need to be heard on this here program. We're also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, and Cairo Radio apps, or just visit our website, air-raid.net, to subscribe directly to the RSS feed and access the archives. Okay? Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/theairraidpodcast, or follow us on Twitter @airraidnet, or you can email me directly. Tell us how you like the show, how long you've been listening, where you're from, all that good stuff at aaron@air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge. Tell your friends about the show. Spread it around. We still want it to be spread around, right? Okay. All right. We're going to end this here episode, folks. End it. This is the song Once and Only by Caustic Resin, off of the now re-released 1998 release, The Medicine Is All Gone on Alias Records. Go and get the re-release, folks. Please. You will not be sorry. If you like this type of music, if you've liked Built to Spill in the past, this is going to be right up your alley, okay? Go and check it out. The Medicine Is All Gone on vinyl. I got to get my hands on that. I should probably get a record player as well. That might be a good thing. Might be a good thing, right? All right. This is Once and Only by Caustic Resin, and we'll be back next week with an all-new episode of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. We love you, folks. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.